Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A defining characteristic of America's democracy is fast becoming that millions of its citizens don't vote. Early estimates set voter turnout at a paltry 40% for today's midterm elections. With control of Congress and major policy decisions hanging in the balance, why are so many Americans taking a pass on voting day? In this hour, some modest proposals for jump-starting the American electorate. We begin with the latest on today's 2002 elections. The polls have closed in Kentucky and Indiana. They're closing in Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, Vermont, and Virginia as we speak. Joining me now from Washington is Gail Shattuck, congressional reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. Good evening and welcome, Gail.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. Gail, what's it look like? Can we tell anything at all at this hour about how today's voting has gone?
Tom, there is a very good chance we're not going to be able to tell anything at midnight or at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning about how today's voting went.
You're talking about the voter news service going down.
Exactly. I think that for those in the media, that is the big news of the day.
Remind us, what is this service and how has it gone down on Election Day?
Voter News Service is a consortium of big networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, and I think the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. It, among other things, it projects winners on election night.
How does it do that normally?
Exit polls. Mm-hmm. Takes a look at the exit polls, does some statistical calculations, and projects ahead. This was very controversial, you remember, in the last presidential election because some of those projections were wrong.
They were all over the place and inaccurate.
All over the place, depressed votes. So Voters News Service wanted to really improve its operation. Unfortunately, it was really a four-year project, and they weren't quite ready for prime time for this election.
So at 5:30 this evening, we got the Reuters report, 5:29, saying there would not be any exit polls on Tuesday today because of unreliable data.
That's right.
Mysterious.
There's another aspect that for journalists is a real disaster, which is I think there's something like 19 newspapers do a lot of their analysis of why people voted, mm-hmm. white, black, Hispanic, gender, age, and so forth, out of those exit polls. So a really rich source of early analysis of those elections is also likely not going to be there. There's a lot of scrambling behind the scenes to make up for it.
It must be incredible with the networks, Gail. They've got hours to fill tonight, and
yes.
Now they won't have those numbers coming in as we speak.
I think they're going to bring in all the experts from the sniper case to speculate about voters.
It looks like the revenge of the year 2000 here on Voter News Service. Again, does it mean, Gail, that we'll never know what that demographic breakdown of the vote is? Is there any other way of knowing other than exit polls?
Well, that of course is a huge question. Some of the networks anticipating this problem started their own surveys over the weekends. Of course, the best surveys in the country are the ones that candidates and political parties did. Be interesting mm-hmm. to see if those are exploited in a richer way than they have been in the past.
But it looks like
also may be some material that comes out of this National mm-hmm. Voter Survey mm-hmm. in the end. But they just don't want to use it in a way that could possibly be wrong and misleading again so soon and early in the cycle.
This is just great. And somehow looks like divine justice that in the year 2000 we'll be waiting to get results the old-fashioned way, actually counting them up. Apart from the lack of early projections, and that will be a mind-bender as the night goes on with the networks trying to fill that time, but apart from that, Gail, what has it looked like across the country today? We've had an awful lot of Justice Department representatives and attorneys from each party out there watching the polls. Have things worked fairly smoothly? Have there been significant problems?
Not significant. There have been some glitches in places where you might expect them. Broward County had to take, I think, 40 to 50 of its new touch screen machines offline. In Georgia, which also went heavily high-tech voting this year, mm-hmm. there were some, I think, two counties that listed the wrong races for county commissioner. Maryland, which had a lot of problems in Montgomery County, which also went from punch ballots to touchtone screens in the primaries. As I was voting this morning, there was someone at a Booth that kept complaining that he kept trying to vote for one candidate for governor and the other one was registered on the screen. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting was there had been such a focus on this problem that there were, I think, 1,000 more trained workers mm-hmm. in these polling places in the general election that were not there in the primary. So immediately, you know, experts are converging on this man and his machine to try to solve the problem. I think that's been more the rule. There have been glitches, but there's such scrutiny of this campaign that there's been an immediate response.
And what about on Capitol Hill, where the politicians are plugged into all the private party polling, Gail, as we've approached Election Day? Who's looking more confident? Is anybody wearing that Cheshire Cat grin, or is it really a toss-up?
I think Republicans look very confident right now. Trent Lott, about an hour ago, started talking about what he would do with his new title as majority leader. Of the Senate. Judicial nominations would go quicker, homeland security, port security, and so forth. There are people that think that there may be some surprises with Republicans, but, you know, it all turns on the question you folks are focusing on tonight, which is turnout. Mm-hmm. All of these projections depend on certain assumptions that people will and will not show up.
President Bush was out beating the bushes again today, saying we need that big vote. Do Republicans want a big turnout? Is it really good for them?
Traditionally, it hasn't been. I mean, the traditional wisdom is that if non-voters, which tend to be poorer, younger, and so forth, actually voted, it would benefit Democrats. The Monitor had a piece this morning that kind of argued that that wasn't the case. So I don't know, maybe that's more up in the air than it used to be. But I'll tell you a very interesting case on the question you're looking at is South Dakota, which had a huge, very quiet effort all year to register Indians on reservations. They put hundreds of thousands of dollars into it. A very key, very tight Senate race. This will be one of the most important, go down to the wire.
Mm-hmm.
But I was on some of these reservations listening to some of these discussions, and it was just trying to convince Native Americans that they have a stake in this country and that it's important that they vote. The Republicans were also on the reservations trying to convince Native Americans to go in another way. There have been examples of fraud that have already come out of that effort. Republicans are watching very closely to make sure that everyone who is claimed to be a new voter is actually alive, living where they say they are.
But there's an example of a community that could swing a nation if it came out to vote. Gail, without the early projections that people normally expect to have, when might we be getting some clear understanding of who's going to have control of the House and Senate coming out of this election day?
You know, the Senate race, if it comes out as evenly divided as people think it will, could turn on a runoff in Louisiana that doesn't occur until December. So this could be a very long wait to decide who controls this body.
That would be a long time. If Louisiana doesn't end up deadlocked in that way, how soon could we know? Do you have a sense?
I think it's possible we could know tomorrow morning. But there's just so many close races and contested issues that it could easily take longer.
Well, we're doing it the old-fashioned way. Gail Shattuck, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Glad to.
Gail Shattuck is congressional reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. The majority of eligible Americans didn't vote today. But imagine for a minute if 70, 80, or 90% of Americans did vote. How would it change the political system, the political climate in America? What would it take to make that happen? Did you vote in the midterm elections, or are you one of the millions of Americans who opted out? And if you are a non-voter, what would it take to get you to the polls? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Walter Dean Burnham, professor of government at the University of Texas. Good evening and welcome, Walter Dean Burnham.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Professor Burnham.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Professor Burnham, help us understand the low turnouts we're seeing in American elections in historical context. Have we voted at a higher rate historically? Is it just contemporary Americans who are the no-shows at the polls? Has it ebbed and flowed through our history? What's the pattern look like?
Well, historically, in the 19th century, turnouts were very much higher than they are at the present time. leaving the South aside, which had a special history,
mm-hmm.
three-quarters of the potentially eligible voters participated in off-year congressional elections once in a while, 1866, 1894, for instance.
So as high as 70% compared to 40%
yeah,
or less than
75%, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in 1896, there's a big, very pivotal election, which was decisive in the Midwest in particular, and there are a string of states there, seven of them, from West Virginia to Iowa, including all the east north central states, where the turnout rate was in excess of 90%.
Wow.
As compared to 57% for the same states in the year 2000. That gives you some idea of the spread.
So the historical pattern was high voting. Has it been a steady decline, and when did
well,
it tip into a decline?
It's been a kind of roller coaster. It declined very sharply after 1900, reaching a bottom in the 1920s.
Now, this was because women began to vote but weren't accustomed to exercising that yet?
That. Partly that, but partly other factors were involved as well. Demobilization was a big fact of life. Republicans were in charge. The Democrats were all over the place. It was a solidly conservative era and so on. And then the New Deal, you get a lot more turnout, particularly in the lower classes in the North. And so the turnout goes up again and stays pretty much high, relatively high for 20th century standards between 1940 and 1965.
And then since the 60s?
It's been downhill.
Why?
Well, that's a good question. It's a puzzle, some people say, who do survey research, because they say, well, gee, people who are more likely to be higher educated and more affluent and so on are more likely to vote, you know. And if you take a look at the demographics from 1960 to 2000, there's been a huge increase in the general level of formal education in this country.
Meaning that less educated people are voting in much smaller numbers or
no,
percentage?
You should have, if all other things considered, the turnout should be 15 points higher than it is, particularly if you take into account the various devices used to make it easier to get registered and, user-friendly absentee voting systems and all the rest of it that we've had since then.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to say what's going on, and I think the obvious answer has to do with whatever has happened to our politics over the past 40 years. And I think what that is the disappearance of older kinds of parties and older kinds of solidarities and the development of kind of TV, couch potato, et cetera, kinds of patterns.
You talk about the party of the non-voter. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a metaphor. There's not an organized party, obviously. They're not marching to the polls saying in unison, we will not vote, and then marching away. What you have, however, is if you take a look at the demographics again, the party of what you could call the party of non-voters is very heavily predominantly less well-educated and at the bottom half of the occupational structure. People who
that means income.
Yeah, well, in terms of occupation and income, mm-hmm. they're all related to each other. It's mm-hmm. a class issue. There's more difference in class terms between voters and non-voters than between Republicans and Democrats.
Jack Beatty, it makes one wonder what America would look like if everybody did come out and vote.
Yes, taking Dean's analysis there, he would say that the society would be more equitable.
How so?
Well, that the people at the bottom rungs who would be the new voters would, for example, not tolerate a minimum wage that in real terms is appreciably below what it was even as recently as the 1980s. They would not tolerate a system that ties health insurance to a job. They would ask for health security. They would not tolerate probably the degree of economic insecurity we have in America, in which people can be fired and laid off and downsized and so on. And I think, in short, there'd be the whole economic aspect of our politics would change. But one of the things that's happened is that our politics is really about values now. It's not about economics. And these people have been left out of that. I mean, it doesn't matter to them whether, you know, abortion rights are important, but that's not the an issue for someone who's at the minimum wage. That's not the main concern of their lives. Whereas that really is, I think, that and the issues that symbolize the big divide between the parties.
Jack Beatty, Walter Dean Burnham, stand by. We are talking tonight about the missing American voter and some not-so-modest proposals for getting folks back in the voting booth. We've got all kinds of ideas we're going to put before you. See what you think. Did you vote today? If not, why not? If you did, what motivates you to get to the polls? And what would American politics look like if all Americans voted? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on Election Day about the missing American voter, and we're going to throw before you some not-so-modest proposals for getting Americans back in the voting booth. Question is, does democracy work if less than half of us vote? Should Election Day be a holiday? Would you go to the polls or to the beach if it were? Should Election Day have mandatory voting, or does that sound like Saddam Hussein's Iraq? What's your idea for how to turn out the American electorate? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Walter Dean Burnham. He's professor of government at the University of Texas. And we're joined now by Martin Wattenberg. He's joining us from Newport Beach, California. He's professor of political science at the University of California, Irvine, and author of Where Have All the Voters Gone? Good evening and welcome, Martin Wattenberg.
Hi, my pleasure to be here.
We're delighted to have you. You've been looking at this for a long time. Lay before us, if you would, Martin Wattenberg, some of the ideas for how we might get more Americans to the polls. We saw William Sapphire in a column yesterday saying every hair-shirted goo-goo goes into a hand-wringing fit over the subject of voter turnout. Yet I think as Americans we'd all feel better if there were more people at the polls. How could we accomplish it?
Well, a lot of people think the Constitution says that we have to vote on Tuesday, and that's not true. It was set by Congress. Article 1, Section 3 gives Congress the power to set the times, places, and manner of federal elections. And we've just continued to do Tuesday for all these years.
So do you think Wednesday would be better, or Saturday, or Sunday, or what are you suggesting?
Well, I go Saturday, Sunday, or make a national holiday.
Now, what?
Basically, the number one reason people give in the census surveys, mm-hmm. where they ask 100,000 people, why are you registered and did you vote? Of the people who were registered and did not vote, number one reason now is too busy, didn't have enough time, too busy at work or school.
Do you believe that, Martin Wattenberg?
Yeah, I believe it. I see it in my students all the time. They're too busy.
Too busy, but, I mean, people have time to go and get a cup of coffee. They have time to watch a television show in the evening. I mean, you know what busy is. Busy is a flexible thing.
I had to vote on in Newport Beach this year. How many punches I had to make?
So is that? Are you saying it just took too many minutes, or it's too complicated? I mean, is this
a lot of things? It was 50 things I had to vote on. 50.
So if it were a national holiday, would you be more willing to go in and spend, or do you think American voters would be more willing to go in and spend their day punching those 50 holes?
Well, I hope so. In any case, they wouldn't have an excuse, and I can tell you, no new democracy is adopting a election day in the middle of the week. And we would never, our observers and experts would never go over and tell them to emulate us. All the new democracies are voting on the weekend.
So handicap this for us. What do you see as the chances that American voting will move to the weekend or that it would become a national holiday?
Not much. I don't think there's any real concern about it in Congress. I think it's highly unlikely.
Okay, so we'll set that one up there, see what we think of making it a holiday. What about making voting mandatory? Australia has that. Brazil has that. A bunch of other countries.
No way, Jose.
Is that you, Walter Dean Burnham?
Yes, it is.
And why do you say no way, Jose?
This is a highly libertarian-type country. We don't believe in, for example, having state enrollment of voters to eliminate the personal registration problem. It's un-American. The notion that you're going to compel people to do something is very alien to the national character. I don't think you could possibly manage to get any action of that type.
William Sapphire quoted people calling that the Saddam solution we saw just a week or two ago.
Sure.
How Iraqis
well,
are in,
would,
required.
You know. Of course he would.
Well,
you know,
of course he would.
You know, Australia is not Saddam Hussein LaVille, but they have it and they live with it.
How does it work in Australia?
Well, you pay $2 if you don't vote for some for a stated reason. If you're sick or something, it's another story. But if you just
excuse
don't
me, did
vote,
you say $2?
No, it's more than that. I'm sorry. I lived in Australia for a while. It's $20.
I'm sorry, I meant $20.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
$20. I mean, it's still, we're talking pocket change. Does it work?
Yes, it works incredibly well. 95% of registered voters.
Of course, you do get a lot of blank ballots that way.
You get a few blank ballots. It's actually not that big. You get a few of the donkey vote, where they just go in and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
The donkey vote. Wait a minute. That's a Democratic vote in America.
Yeah, well, donkey vote just means pin the tail on the donkey. They have to rank order candidates and just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm out of here.
Because they haven't paid attention, they just go in to dutifully put something in the ballot.
They don't want to pay the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it doesn't make any difference because it all the candidates are listed in random order, and it's about 2% of the people. I want to tell you that surveys in Australia, they've had this for 80 years in Australia. Surveys regularly find 2/3 of Australians support the idea of keeping mandatory voting.
That's interesting.
So they like it. You have, I guess we've also heard about Sapphire proposes, and he's getting a little tongue-in-cheek here maybe, but he says make voting rewarding. Give a $100 tax credit to everybody who steps into the voting booth. Can you imagine that, Martin Wattenberg?
I don't particularly like that. It's your civic duty. And I actually think mandatory voting is a great thing. I know it has no chance in the United States, but it's something you're supposed to do. And so I don't like the idea of paying somebody to do something that they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. But as I forget, perhaps it was you said, we follow in the philosophical political tradition of John Locke, not Jeremy Bentham, not the greatest good, but individual liberty.
Yeah,
right.
That's it.
So don't tread on me. Don't force me into that voting booth.
However, we do make people register for the draft when we have a draft, and we make them go to war when we have a draft, and we could use the same principle to do this, and it would really be better for all of us. The big change is, I heard all this discussion about class and education earlier, is young people. We have an incredible bias at the polls in terms of young
people. Very true.
And you see all the issues today are Social Security, Medicare, prescription drugs. Let me tell you, when you go to Australia and you watch an election campaign, they talk about everybody's issues because they know everybody's going to vote.
Beach volleyball, you know, surfing.
Actually, I did a survey in Australia where I asked people in the question, you know, it's a national survey, do you think the issues of your generation are being represented? And I had the same survey in five counties in California, and the results are very different. In Australia, the Australian young people think politicians are listening to them, to their generation.
And indeed, if they're voting, they are.
Because they're voting, because they have to vote. But you know what? They're apathetic, too. If you ask them their interest in politics, Australian young people is very low, just like American young people. But they think that the politicians listen to them because they know they're going to vote.
Jack Beatty, should we be, are we putting on an unnecessary hair shirt to care so about this? Should we be pushing for extreme steps to change the voting trends in the United States?
Well, you know, I think obviously it would give more content to our democracy if we had better representation. When you have things like the California system this year, what you really are looking at is the parties are about incumbency now. They're not really about political competition. There are 153 state legislative and congressional districts in California. And so far as I can tell, only one of them, Gary Condit's seat, is competitive, or maybe there are others.
So when you say the California system, you mean the redistricting to guarantee incumbents re-election?
That the two parties have colluded to have no political competition. And here's where people who favor proportional representation come in. They say that, wait a minute, why are you, you know, if you get 49, if you get 50% of the vote, the guy that gets 49, the party that gets 49% in your district has no representation at all. Why not give them an extra seat by increasing the number of seats in the House of Representatives and going to a system away from our first-past-the-post system, winner-take-all system, to a proportional representation system? That would get more participation.
Walter Dean Burnham, could we do that without a change in the U.S. Constitution?
I don't believe that is very likely, again. There's a book out there by somebody whose name I forget called The Frozen Republic. And it really argues that we are indeed frozen and find it exceedingly difficult to make any kind of reform or innovation in any direction that has to do with the distribution of political power, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's exactly right. But note what this. Let me just note the numbers that are involved.
Yes.
We're talking 40%. We think for
turnout today.
Mm-hmm. The potential electors, as far as I can calculate, is almost exactly 200 million. That means that you're talking about, if you get up to 40%, which would mean you'd be getting about 2% higher than it was in 1998,
mm-hmm.
you would have 120 million people who wouldn't be voting, and 80 million who would. That gives you some idea of the magnitude to the sheer volume of it all.
It's mind-boggling, and one really does wonder what the country would look like if even a significant portion of that 120 million swung in. Would be very interesting indeed. Walter Dean Burnham, Martin Wattenberg, stand by. I want to bring our callers in. We have a lot who want to join this conversation. Lewis is calling from Neenah, Wisconsin. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I'm wondering, and I voted today. I think it's a, well, basically, if I don't vote, I guess I can't whine about the results.
And you want to whine.
Yeah, but I'm wondering about, given the fact that we have polls on any kind of an issue constantly mm-hmm. that represent a very tiny minority of the population, mm-hmm. and yet these polls have been proven to be accurate to represent the majority of the population, does it really matter if we have an 80% turnout? I'm not trying to discourage voter turnout. I think it's very important, but will 40% really be any different than an 80% turnout?
Well, this is the really practical question. I love it. Thanks for putting it in here, Lewis. Let me put that to Walter Dean Burnham. Would it make a difference? Let's say that 50 or 60 or 70 of that 120 million non-voting Americans turned out. Would it change American politics?
Well, I think that Martin Wattenberg had a fairly good point here. When you have a large volume of turnout, you reduce the bias in the system. I mean, he was talking about the extent to which people talk, for example, in Australia about youth issues
mm-hmm.
that are concerning young people, and not just, say, prescription drugs and all the rest of it. And that, I think, is a more general kind of situation. There's an old saying, if you don't vote, you don't count.
But Lewis says, and there's a certain logic to it. We see a lot of polls out there polling the entire American public, or supposedly doing so. What happens in the elections doesn't seem to come up that different from what the polls say. So does that then suggest that what we see in the voting booth, Martin Wattenberg, is a pretty good reflection of what Americans, how they feel, of their opinions at large?
Oh, I don't believe that at all. I think young people's opinions are quite different. I analyze that in detail. And the politicians know that these polls are not representative. A poll of the entire population is not representative of the people that vote. And they know who their constituents are, and they know it's older people, not younger people.
Right.
But I guess that's just the point. If the polls are representative of everyone, but yet the voting turns out to pretty well line up with the polls, does that suggest that more voters would be more of the same or something else, Martin Wattenberg? What do you think?
The polls are just of the people who are likely voters. Does he mean, you mean that the polls actually predict the elections reasonably well?
Oh, no, there's an important distinction. So when the pollsters gear up their machinery in advance of voting day, they're only looking at likely voters, you're saying?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't all that great either. I mean, they were off by a pretty big percentage. And if you read the New York Times, I think it was today, it's like, these polls are becoming more and more problematic as cell phones come in and the response rates are actually getting worse and worse. It's sort of the hidden story in polling.
Exactly.
We see Stanley Greenberg, the great pollster, saying that Americans have learned not to pick up the phone. They can see on the answering machine who's calling, or they're on their cell phone. And so
right.
the whole tradition of telephone polling is kind of coming apart at the seams.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's get more callers in. Lewis, thanks for calling. Richard's on the line. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Well, I voted today, but I only voted because I wanted to set a good example for my daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that my daughters, who watch more TV than I do, were telling me was that the ads are just awful. They couldn't even. I said, "Who should I vote for on the basis of what you saw?" And they said, "They all act like kids." What I want to suggest is, I like John McCain's suggestion. I think it's just outrageous that the television and radio is so expensive that our candidates spend all of their time raising money so that they can then put stupid ads on instead of giving them time so that they can actually address substantive issues.
So are you saying that you're one of the people for whom negative campaign ads is a turnoff? You understand how it might turn people away from the polls?
Yeah, it's a turnoff. I mean, what are you going to do? Who are you going to reward?
Well, we've talked about that on this show. Jack Beatty, what do you think? Are we actually driving voters away with the very content or lack of content of the political debate?
I think that's true. I mean, for years, political consultants have said, well, you drive down turnout with these negative ads, and that's the way they want it. They just want motivated voters. But, you know, in this cycle, $1 billion is going to be spent on television ads, most of it, these negative ads. And that not only drives away the independent voter and sort of besmirches our whole idea of a democratic debate, it means that the candidates are in hock to the people who gave them the billion. They are the ruling class. And that, of course, gets back to the issue of what the agenda of politics is. The agenda of politics is what these people who give the $1 billion want.
We want to fix this. Martin Waterberg, what about, we've got another Sapphire proposal here, which is make voting easier, to scrap traditional communal voting places and let voters vote absentee, let them mail it in. I think Oregon is voting on
that
today.
Sure.
Even let voters vote by email. Is there a way to bring the process into the 21st century, make it more accessible?
Well, I certainly think we need to simplify things. In most countries, they only vote for one, two, three things when they go to the polls. You know, going to the polls and voting for 50 things is just outrageous, in my view. It asks way too much of people. As for mail ballots, you know, Oregon's doing that, and it really hasn't made any difference for the general elections. It helps sometimes with a really sort of low-interest special election, mm-hmm. like when they had a special election for a senator in Oregon.
And what about the Internet?
The Internet's just not secure enough. Mm-hmm. Nobody's been able to work that out yet. And that would also, I think, just make voting even more biased. The people who have high-speed Internet access will be more likely to vote, and that's mm-hmm. like 10% of the population right now.
Walter Dean Burnham, we do not want to accept this frozen republic. We want to mix it up and change it. What's the way here?
If I only knew, as the saying goes, if I could have figured that out, then who knows? I could become king of the mountains.
We don't really want you as king either. Nothing personal.
Behind my proposals, it really means essentially what you're talking about is what you've got to do is try to find some way of creating a political organization as a collective enterprise and attracting people to a cause. That whatever that organization is about, and pulling them out of their chairs and getting them excited about politics. If you can't do that, all these bells and whistles of modern technology aren't going to make a damn bit of a difference.
So you're saying don't wait for the current system to change itself. It's not going to happen. It boils down to old-fashioned politics and leadership.
The system has got to be heavily, what shall we say, the system has to be impacted heavily by some demand for real change, which is so intense that politicians have to try to actually do something. And we've seen a tiny bit of this with regard to McCain-Feingold and all the stuff that supposedly ended soft money after this election. But we need a lot more than that. Without it, you're not going to get appreciably different. I think we're approximately at an equilibrium point. I doubt that turnout will get much lower than about 40% nationwide in off-year elections, but I certainly don't think it's likely to climb a whole lot until something like that happens.
How
do you put that together? I have really no idea at this point.
Well, 120 million Americans standing on the outside not voting. We're talking tonight about the missing American voter. Looking at some not-so-modest proposals for getting Americans back in the voting booth. What do you think? Should we pay Americans to vote with a tax rebate? Should we let them vote online? What's your modest proposal for getting out the vote? And what's your diagnosis of the massive no-show? Do you really want every eligible American to vote? Would that be welcome or threatening to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight on Election Day about the missing American voter and putting out some not-so-modest proposals for getting Americans back in the voting booth, making voting mandatory. What about that? Paying Americans to vote, penalizing them if they don't vote, making it a national holiday. What would actually work here? Did you vote today? And if not, why not? If you did, what motivates you to go to the polls? And what would American politics look like if all Americans voted. My guests tonight are Walter Dean Burnham, joining us from Austin, Texas. He's professor of government at the University of Texas. And Martin Wattenberg, joining us from Newport Beach, California, professor of political science at the University of California, Irvine, and author of Where Have All the Voters Gone? Today is a voting day. Polls have just closed 10 minutes ago in Alabama, North Carolina, Ohio, West Virginia. West Virginia Senator Republican John Warner has won re-election. He was not opposed. In Kentucky, we have here Associated Press report projecting victory for Republican Senator Mitch McConnell over Democratic challenger Lois Combs Weinberg. This was not seen as a close or crucial election, but we've got a couple of kind of early returns there. We're going to have less than we expected tonight because the voter survey, the election polling system that all networks depend on, is not working. So it could be a funny evening out there. We welcome your call tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Dan's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a modest revolutionary proposal for you.
Oh, good. Raise the torch high.
I think you need one. Walter Dean Burnham's despair and Mr. Wattenberg's being totally nonplussed about what to do about it really make me upset. And I'd like to propose something which is utterly new and probably out of the realm of possibility, but I'll propose it anyway.
Step up, Dan. We're looking for that idea.
Yeah. I think non-voting is a kind of anti-politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's terribly important to embrace all of politics and politics, including anti-politics.
How do you embrace anti-politics?
Well, we have a structural problem. A lot of people don't vote because they feel there's no point in it because no one represents their interest. The independents plus the party of non-voters are the majority in this country. And yet, when you go to the polls, you are allowed to vote for the two-party establishment, in effect. Democrats or Republicans, or no one at all.
So how do you make way for antimatter in the system?
Exactly. So what we should do is we should create bipolar voting.
It sounds like a disease.
What we need is a column that says vote yes for a candidate or vote no for a candidate, very much like we do with issues.
Ooh.
And the reason is if you assign a plus one to the positive vote and a minus one to the negative vote, then you require that the sum for any candidate be greater than zero in order for them to assume office. This is a perfectly sensible way to energize a non-voting electorate. I assume that many people who don't want to vote for Ted Kennedy would very much like to vote against him, but they don't have that opportunity.
Vote for his opponent.
I don't object to Ted Kennedy, but
Dan, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
In a two-party system, isn't voting for the other party a kind of bipolar system?
Well, no, not really. It's voting for the lesser of evils. I think a lot of people don't like either Republicans or Democrats, and they would like another alternative. But often a third party seems to be a wasted vote. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to even up the playing field.
Voting. You sound like a physicist, Dan.
Well, actually, you hit the nail on the head. I am a physicist. And I recently collaborated with a political scientist, Ted Lowy at Cornell University, to publish this theory in the Journal of Political Science, PS, and we recently did that last June, I think.
The bipolar voting, vote yes or no. Jack Beatty, what do you think? Do you want to see that? Thumbs up, thumbs down, and the candidate has to come out with a net positive bigger than his opponents to win?
The physics of voting, I'm intrigued. Marty, isn't it true that California or one of these states has a none of the above?
Nevada does.
What happens with none of the above?
One of the lowest turnout rates.
It has one of the lowest.
Despite the fact that it has that option.
So that would suggest that it's not enough to give people a chance to kick someone they don't like.
I would say so.
Still, Dan, we like your ambition, and keep working on it. Thanks for calling. Bill's calling from Lake Mills, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much. I've got a surefire way of increasing. By the way, I have to compliment Dan on his anti-politics theory because it's probably also true. So we're not going to go after those people. We're going to let them not vote. But what I want to do is give you a surefire way of increasing, if we wanted to, by 20%.
We're wide open. What do you got?
Okay. This is something that's not original. Everybody knows it. It's already been said on the radio and on public radio today. Number one, the weather is the biggest barrier. So what do? We move it from November to October. No problem.
Where the weather's likely to be better.
Absolutely.
Okay.
November is a terrible time.
Yeah.
Especially up here in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, we already mentioned it. We move it to Saturday. No problem.
And do you think that would really bring in a higher turnout, Bill, or is that the day that people want to go off to the beach, to the bowling alley?
It's not the day working people want to work is the bigger barrier because
yeah.
My family, 4 out of 5 of us got to vote because we were on the road working.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now another thing.
Yes.
One more. Last thing, and this is probably the most important thing.
Okay, okay.
Multiple days. I'm getting my billings out right now for the end of the quarter, and there is no way I can get all my billings out in one day. Why can't we have multiple days to vote? If I have to be on the road working on one day, there's no sense in rushing it. It'll happen.
Well, there's a good list. Martin Wattenberg, how about it? Move it to October, have multiple days.
Sure, October would be better. The November was chosen because it had to do with the harvest season back in the 19th century.
Get the crop in before you require us to go off to vote.
Yeah, it's another really outdated thing. So, sure, that would be good. I never thought about that, but might as well move it to October for changing the date. The countries that have dealt with elections over multiple days, they haven't done so well.
Why not?
I don't know.
You don't get that critical mass of attention focused on things?
Yeah, probably. But I tell you, the countries that vote on the weekend do get about 5-6% higher turnout.
Walter Dean Burnham, is it your sense?
Enough. Once upon a time, presidential elections in some states were held on multiple days. That was way back in around 1840 or so. But then they cleaned everything up and made everybody vote the same day.
Have there been times before in American history when our voting turnout was low and there were changes made in the system that effectively bumped it up, Walter Dean Burnham?
I don't really recall any mechanical change that had that effect. There may have been
black turnout in the South.
What?
Black turnout in the South, civil rights.
Black turnout. Well,
sure.
Yeah.
When you bring in the Reconstruction and then the Second Reconstruction efforts and so on to smash up an apartheid regime, that's a totally different enterprise. It's exceedingly important. It's an important minority theme.
But we're all in the pool now. It's just half of us aren't swimming. Jeff is on the line. Welcome, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I love all the ideas. They're great. I got a modest, impossible proposal.
Lay it on us.
I feel that nation-state ballot access laws are rather stringent, and if states and the nation would decrease lessen their ballot access laws to allow more accessibility to third parties, make it easier for them to get on the ballot, and then make it easier, decrease the current thresholds of percentage of vote.
So if I can break that down, you're saying nation state, okay, the country, just make it easier for third parties to get on the ballot. Why would that, in your mind, increase voter turnout, Jeff?
Well, the key is, actually, once they put a lot of energy just to get on the ballot to begin with, and they expend a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. But if they can get on the ballot, and then if they have longevity on the ballot, if the threshold's at 2%, let's say, they get 2% and they're guaranteed to be on the ballot next year, that gives them a chance to build their constituency, which...
Sure, because there's something to vote for, and it would surely mix up the options here. Martin Wattenberg, how about it? More independent parties, would that mean more voters?
I would help a little bit. Let me tell you, the California ballot, it's pretty easy to get on, and we've got a lot of parties, and that's actually... You know, one of the reasons why the ballot is so long, because not only do we have lots of offices, we have lots of parties running for them. Gets a marginal percentage of people out. It's a good thing to do, but it's not going to make a big difference.
We're trying to figure out how to get that 120 million missing American voters to the polls. Michelle's calling. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air.
Hi, I just have a comment. I did vote today.
Okay.
My boyfriend wanted to vote. However, he left very early this morning and drove an hour away from where he could have voted.
Mm-hmm.
He's not home yet. The polls close in 5 minutes. He will be unable to vote. We talked about this election a lot. We talked about who we wanted to vote for. It was a big part of our conversation.
Yeah.
And I think that somehow, you know, this idea that, yes, people are too busy to vote during the week. Mm-hmm. We do not work in the town that we live in.
And that's not an uncommon situation.
I agree. And so, therefore, we need to make the poll either put it on a Saturday or we need to make it possible for someone to vote in another town, even if they don't live there.
It's a very good idea, but you know, excuse me.
Walter Dean Burnham, please.
Let me just note one thing about that. Texas has perhaps the most user-friendly system that I've ever seen.
Describe it for us.
Well, you have no-fault absentee voting that occurs on a number of days prior to the actual day of the election.
That means you can walk in somewhere and vote?
Yeah, about one quarter of all the votes cast in Travis County are cast by people
who indeed go on a Saturday to a polling place and vote, as I did.
And how's the turnout look as a result?
That's the other problem. Texas has very poor turnout. We had about 30% turnout in the 1998 gubernatorial election. It was less for other offices in 1998. I don't think it's going to be a lot higher this year, although it might be. We tend to be about 45th or so among the 50 states in terms of our general turnout levels, and that despite the system. But I certainly think it's a good idea. I would recommend, for whatever it's worth as a practical matter, to have something like it everywhere in the country.
Given the kinds of shifts that people work on these days, which can sit anywhere within 24 hours, and the kind of commutes people have, it makes a lot of sense. Michelle, thank you for your call. Janet's calling. Hi, Janet. You're on the air.
Hi. I work in New Hampshire with a lot of kids who haven't completed traditional high school, and if they did, they weren't getting a lot of what was going on in the civics classes. And
okay.
I think part of why they're disenfranchised is that they don't understand how the process works, and our public schools aren't working as the training for civic leadership. I also think if we got rid of TV and radio ads and used some of that money that we talk about spending as a public on voter registration and getting out into lower-income communities and doing some community education, that would be money much better spent than funding negative ads on TV.
Now, there's a thought, Janet. Maybe put a tax, a percentage of spending on TV advertising that would go to voter registration. Janet, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, running through all of this is a kind of undercurrent of sense that things are not going to change, are not going to change easily, and maybe that neither party really sees a huge interest in change.
I think that's right, except that it would help the Democrats, I think. For example, in 1993-94, if they had been able to expand the welfare state through national health insurance, that would have made a lot of constituents, in fact, a lot of Democrats. In fact, at the time, Bill Kristol wrote a memo to Senator Dole and others, and he said, look, what I'm worried about with this Clinton health care insurance plan is that it will work and it'll make Democrats, and we've got to beat it for that reason. In other words, he wasn't trying to beat it on the merits. He was afraid it would work.
But I don't see high-profile Democrats, busting down the barn door to change the impediments to voting in America, to change the system.
Well, I know, but you see, I think this stuff about the system is secondary to the menu, and it's secondary to the question of who's politics for. If it's for the people that give the $1 billion, it's going to just leave lots of other people out. You could practically, pay them to vote, and they wouldn't vote because it's not about them. It's about the ruling class here.
Walter Dean Burnham, a final thought from you. Where do we go with this energy? We'd like to change this situation.
Well, the argument that was made by an earlier caller that you ought to reduce drastically the ballot access threshold for parties is, I think, a very good idea. It wouldn't by itself, as Martin points out, result in a revolution of turnout. But, there's an example of collusion between the two parties. It used to be, again, in the 19th century that you could have easy access and also that you could have fusion candidacies while each party retained its separate identity. You can still do that in New York State, but you can't do it anywhere else that I know of. And, making it essentially more open playing field. The parties tried to stamp out, the two major parties tried to stamp out third parties, and we're very successful at it.
So lower the bar and get those third parties in. Walter Dean Burnham, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Our time's running down, but it's been great having you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. And Martin Wattenberg, I'm sorry our clock is just going, but it's been great having you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Martin Wattenberg is professor of political science at the University of California, Irvine, and author of Where Have All the Voters Gone? Walter Dean Burnham is professor of government at the University of Texas. Jack, that voter survey system is not working tonight. Can you imagine what it's going to be like? We'll hear Cokie Roberts and Dan Shore struggle with that in the next hour, and all the big anchors in the hours ahead. Boy, that there's a radical change tonight.
We're going to hear a lot of thumb sucking, I think.
Yeah, a great sound of sucking, and it will be thumbs. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
All right.
Listeners, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.